Tonight we're going to be talking about some negative things. We're going to be talking about punishment. And I think it's biblical. But that is, and comes after, that is only utilized after you've already established good communication systems, and you've spent a lot of time in guidance, in positive guidance. Remember the story about the reflector? Where my dad spent 4 hours of his time getting across a principle to me so I would understand that principle, and hopefully the necessity of exerting some type of negative discipline would be avoided. And I believe it was. Now that's a prerequisite. I want to emphasize that, because some of you may get the opinion that I believe that negative discipline is the only way to get people to do something. That's not. That's kind of the last ditch method we use when all else has failed. You know, we use these methods of positive communication and positive guidance and spending a lot of time and displaying a lot of love and acceptance, and that is a prerequisite to discipline. And remember, we're talking about the true masculine role, and communications that we talked about last week is definitely the leader's responsibility. And remember, the masculine role is to be the leader in the home. So it's your responsibility to make sure people in your family are communicating one with another and with you. It's your responsibility to set up these systems. It's your responsibility to train them in how to communicate. You know, talk about some of the principles we talked about. Make them aware of the fact that there is a problem in communicating. You understand this, and you want to make things better by way of communication. That's your role. If you don't do it, it probably won't be done. Okay, now, after we've established that kind of rapport, where you really are communicating with one another, then we get into the subject of discipline. Let's define it, first of all. It's from a Latin word, disco, which means to learn. Or a secondary definition is training to act in accordance to rules. It's a type of training to make you act in accordance with certain rules. We have discipline at our police academy. I had never been in the service before. When I entered the academy, this was all new to me. And I did some funny things. And I was disciplined for it. I was trained to act in accordance to rules, you know. I was doing push-ups one day, and I'd just been over at Catalina Island during my college years. I was over there for the whole summer, each year for 3 years. And I was in good shape. I used to swim 200 yards out to a buoy and back every morning, lifted a few weights. I was doing push-ups, and it really wasn't too much of a strain. And the instructor came by, and he said, Vernon, do it faster. And I looked around, and that didn't make sense to me, because I was in cadence. You know, the instructor was up on the platform, and he's going, hup, one, hup, two, and I was right in cadence, you know. So it didn't make sense to go faster, so I said that. I said, I'm going as fast as everyone else. And I kept on doing it. And the guy got all red in the face. You know, and he said, what did you say? And I made a serious mistake. I said the same thing. I said I'm going as fast as everyone else, because that made sense to me, you know. And he said, I forget whether it was 5 or 10, but, you know, 5 laps. You know, and he got all excited. His voice went up a few pitches, you know, and I saw that he was angry, and I got up and I did my laps, and I came back. And the rest of the day, you know, he'd give me a lot of trouble. Every exercise we'd do, he'd come over and kind of harass me. And so I'd do whatever he said, because I didn't want to do 5 more laps. And when we got into the shower, the guy said, hey, Vernon, you've never been in service, huh? I said, no. They said, well, look, when they tell you to do something, just do it. And sometime it won't make sense, but do it anyhow, okay? And you'll be all right. Training to act in accordance with rules. Discipline. That's one phase of discipline. By the way, I found out there was a reason for that. It seemed kind of silly and stupid to me when I was going through. But you know, sometimes in police work, and not all jobs you have to have this kind of training, but in police work, you know, you're around a building where you've got a barricaded suspect. He's firing rounds at you. And you have a sergeant, and he says, Vernon, get over there behind that wall, you know, and he knows more about it than you do, he's got experience. He's a 15-year veteran, and he's in charge. And you really don't have time to say why, or let's talk about this, Sarge, or that doesn't make sense, you know. Bullets are flying. You've got to do it. And so I found out later there was a reason for getting me to this blind obedience, you know, even though it didn't make sense. But discipline has, as a portion of it, this matter of training to act in accordance with rules. It's also defined in Webster's Dictionary as a method of regulating principles and practice. You've all been regulated in some type of principles, either at school or in your home. And lastly, it's referred to as punishment inflicted by way of correction and training. Punishment inflicted by way of correction and training. Normally, discipline, when we think of discipline, we only think of the last definition, right? Punishment. But it's not really like that. Discipline is the total spectrum of training. The word disciple comes from the same root, disco. When Jesus discipled his followers, that's what he was doing. He was disciplining them. He was training them. He didn't go around whipping them, but he was disciplining them. You know, this concept of discipleship is a very important concept. It's a biblical concept. It's one that Jesus thought enough of to use. You know what he did? He selected 12 men, and he spent 3 years with them. You know, it took time. He lived with them. And he poured his life into them. And he inculcated within them his principles for living. And at the end of those 3 years, they were so discipled or disciplined that they went out and, you know, we're sitting here tonight in a church, a Christian church, ultimately because of these men and a lot like them that were disciplined and discipled into the faith. We as leaders need to recognize this concept of disciplining or discipling followers, you know, whether it be your son or your employees, or anyone that really is under your control, your wife, and of course, most importantly, yourself. You need to discipline and disciple yourself in accordance with principles. It's most important, of course, to have good principles to disciple yourself too. The purpose of discipline, let's look in the Bible to some of these purposes. Proverbs 29:15, it's a method of teaching. Disciplining is discipling is a method of teaching. And here in Proverbs 29, we're talking really about negative discipline. And it says here, scolding and spanking a child helps him to learn. Left to himself, he brings shame to his mother. It's a way of actually teaching. Punishment can be a way of teaching, as long as it's in accordance with biblical principles, as we'll learn tonight. It removes foolishness from him. It also demonstrates love. This is very important. Proverbs 3:11. Young man, do not resent it when God chastens and corrects you, for his punishment is proof of his love. Just as a father punishes a son he delights in to make him better, so the Lord corrects you. And then Proverbs 13:24. Once again, I'm reading tonight from the Living Proverbs. If you refuse to discipline your son, it proves you don't love him. For if you love him, you will be prompt to punish him. Very interesting. I referred, I believe, last week to a camp situation we had in the police department where we took kids from the ghetto area up into the mountains for a week at a time. And I'll never forget the first week we had a group of counselors to help us from UCLA. They were specialists in camping. And we had all kind of discipline built into our program. And they said, hey, you shouldn't do this. This isn't too cool. This is, you know, this is forcing people to do things. And that, we don't think you should do that. You know, I mean, it was really regimented. They'd get up at 6:30 to a siren. They'd do calisthenics. They'd march into a large eating hall. Someone would yell, seats. They'd all sit down together, you know. And it was really very strict discipline. One night, I'll never forget, it was the first week. And it was the second or third night. And this one black young man, it was his night to do KP along with a few other guys, and he said, "Hey, listen, washing dishes is women work. I'm not going to do it." And his consular, who also happened to be black, a police officer, big fella, he said, "You're going to do it." The kid said, "No, I'm not." And, you know, they kind of had a confrontation there, and because of the size of the policeman, the kid decided he would. But he did it bitterly, see? And he went over, and his job was to take the dish from the soapy water and put it in the rinse water. And as he'd bring them out of the rinse water, the first few dishes, every time he'd bring it out, he'd kind of give the dish a flip, and the water would come out, and the police officer was standing right alongside him. He had to do it in order to make him stay there, see? And the water was getting all over the police officer's trousers. And so he said, "Hey, buddy," after the third time, he figured there's a pattern here, you know. He said, "One more time, and your head goes in the rinse water." And he looked at him. The kid looked at him, and you could see his wheels turning, you know. He said, "One more time, and it goes in the rinse water." The next dish, you know. He had to find out if he really meant it. And his head went in the rinse water. And he came out fighting. He was a pretty big kid himself. He came out fighting. And naturally, the policeman got the best of him, and he took him out in the woods there, and he kind of wailed on him a little bit. He gave him a few spanks on the hind end. And he brought him back, and he set him down on a log after he got through doing his job. And he finished the washing, you know, and he sat down. He said, "Now look," he says, "I know you really are mad at me. I can see you're mad at me." Boy, the kid was. If he had a knife, he would have used it right there, you know. He said, "But I want you to think over what just happened." He said, "I told you one more time, and the head goes in the water, right? You did it one more time, right? What did I have to do if I really like you? What did I have to do if I really want you to be a man that'll grow up to be a man that can really live in this society where you get a lot of no's, you know? A lot of people say no to you in your life. I got to prepare you for that. In order to make you a better man, what did I have to do?" You can see the kid's eyes roll, and he began to think over this whole process. And it began to make some sense to him. He said, "One more time. I did it one more time." He said, "If he really likes me, he had to do it." And you know, you could see a change starting to come over this young fellow. And it didn't all happen that night. But by the end of the week, I went back up at camp. I didn't stay the entire week, but I was in charge of the camp. And I went back up at the end of the week. And this kid that was such a bitter, unsocial, antisocial, actually, kid, was following around Officer Ralph Waddy, you know, just like a tail he was following around. You know, everywhere he went, he was there with him. The officer would climb in the Jeep, and the kid's right alongside of him, you know. Waddy had a sailor hat that he turned down, you know, to protect him from sunburn. And that kid, every chance he could get, he'd get it off the officer's head and put it on. He'd say, can I wear it just for a little while, you know. He just idolized him. And at the end of the week, Waddy came up to me. And I'll never forget it, because Waddy's a pretty regular cop, you know, and he's not too emotional or anything. And he looked at me, and he had tears in his eyes. And I said, what happened, Ralph? He said, "The kid wants to come home with me." And he said, "I want to take him." And he said, "The kid said, I'll sleep on a back porch, I'll sleep in a cellar, I'll sleep anywhere if you can be my dad." You see, it really does demonstrate love to discipline someone, and to teach him right from wrong, and to take the time to really show him you care. Here's an interesting principle that's important to learn in this connection. Love, as demonstrated by giving and understanding, is not enough. I want to read something to you. Perhaps the greatest, most common shortcoming during the past 25 years was related to the belief, particularly by new parents, that love is enough in raising children. Apparently, they believe that successful parenthood consisted of two primary obligations. One, raise a child in an atmosphere of genuine affection. And two, satisfy his material and physical needs. They thought, that's it. You do that, you'll be a successful parent. They expected every good and worthwhile virtue to bubble forth from this spring of loving kindness. As time has shown, that was wishful thinking. Love, in the absence of instruction, will not produce a child with self-discipline, self-control, and respect for his fellow man. That's a quote from Dr. James Dobson's book, Dare to Discipline. If you've never read it, I encourage you to get a copy. It really is a good book. And that's an important principle that even Spock has grown to appreciate. He said, you know, I was wrong. I was misinterpreted. And I'm revising my statements a little bit. And he's even said this, that love is demonstrated by giving and understanding is not enough. It's for the good of the discipline. It really helps the person. It makes them be a better person. As I said before, life is full of frustration. Life is full of a lot of what sociologists refer to as denial experiences. You know, when someone denies you of something or you can't have it because you don't have enough money or whatever, that's real life. And you have to be a disciplined person in order to get along in that kind of an environment. If you've had everything given to you all your life, whatever you want, it's difficult for you to live in the real world, because the real world is not like that. It may be that way in your home, but when you get out into real life, you're in trouble. I think the situation on some of our colleges today, especially of about 5 years ago, was a result of that type of upbringing. We had a lot of youngsters in college who had never been exposed in their lives to a denial experience. And so here they are. They get there and they say, we want this. And the college administration said no. And it's the first time anyone had said no to them. And they didn't understand it, and they couldn't cope with it. And so they marched into the administration office because, you know, I've always been given everything I want. They didn't think this consciously, you know, but that's what's going on. And they couldn't cope with a no. But, you know, real life is like that. There's a lot of no's. I get told no a lot. And there's a lot of things that I can't do that I'd like to do. And a well-adjusted person is a person who can learn to cope with the realities of life, including no answers. So it's for the good of the discipline to be a disciplined person and to not always get your way, because that's real life. And most importantly, it's God's way. 1 Samuel 3:13. Then the Lord said to Samuel, I'm going to do a shocking thing in Israel. I'm going to do all of the dreadful things I warned Eli about. I have continually threatened him and his entire family with punishment because his sons are blaspheming God, and he doesn't stop them. You know, the sons of Eli, much was said about them, but the most important thing was that they really were going against God. They were undisciplined, and the Bible indicates that that's ungodly, to be undisciplined. Eli's sons were undisciplined people, and the Bible says that that's not God's way. They blasphemed God by being this way. So I have vowed that the sins of Eli and of his son shall never be forgiven by sacrifices and offerings. Proverbs 10:10. Winking at sin leads to sorrow. Bold reproof leads to peace. Winking at sin leads to sorrow. God's way is always the best way. When you don't go God's way, you're going to have sorrow in your life. Okay, there are some prerequisites to discipline, especially negative discipline. First of all, there has to be strong conviction that what you're about to utilize as discipline principles are really the correct ones. Dr. Henry Brandt says in his book, Building a Christian Home, uncertainty on the part of an adult about the direction that guidance should take indicates a lack of proper study and consideration. You ought to kind of, as the kids say on the street today, you ought to get your act together before you start in the discipline program. You know, you ought to know what you're doing. You ought to have some principles. One of the problems that I've seen as a juvenile officer in homes is where parents don't agree, and they have a conflict in front of the child about discipline. And one says, I think you ought to get spanked. The other, oh, no, that's much too harsh, and, you know, doesn't deserve that. Well, I think that this is wrong. No, well, that isn't too bad. I mean, after all, and there's a big confrontation. And then finally, when he does get spanked, maybe by the dad, you know, and the mother is saying, no, you're too harsh. And when the dad goes in the other room, you know, she goes over and says, now, there, you know, you'll have to excuse your dad. He was, you know, the kid begins to wonder, gee, maybe that wasn't right of my dad to do that. And he begins developing a root of bitterness, as the Bible calls it. He becomes bitter against his parents, and especially his father, and many times the mother, too. In fact, one of the most bitter youngsters I've ever seen, He wasn't bitter against his father who was disciplining him, but he was bitter against his mother who was always championing his cause, and he knew he was wrong deep down inside. And he resented his mother not disciplining him and being actually against his dad. Boy, he almost hated her. It's very important to present a united front. Now, occasionally there will be normal differences of opinion, and you can't get around that. But when you begin to have an open confrontation about discipline, that's the time to say, hey, let's go in the other room. You go in there and shut the door, and you hash it out, and when you come out, you're together. And you say, we've agreed on this. We're going this direction. And that gives the child a sense of security where they think, hey, must be right. They agree. You know, it's really good. So being certain of where you stand is a very important thing. In order to do that, you have to have principles and values upon which guidance is based. Proverbs 2, 6 through 9, give us some insight there. For the Lord grants wisdom. His every word is a treasure of knowledge and understanding. He grants good sense to the godly, his saints. He is their shield, protecting them and guarding their pathway. He shows how to distinguish right from wrong and how to find the right decision every time. What a promise. Of course, that promise is contingent upon knowing his word, because it says his every word is a treasure of knowledge. You've got to know what his book says. And that's why it's really important that you begin very early in your Christian experience to begin to bathe yourself in principles from this book. To memorize them, to study them, to read them. And it doesn't always have to be memorized, but that's very important. You know, the Bible says, thy word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee. In other words, deviate from what he says. That's a very important principle. But reading is also important. A lot of people say, yeah, but you always remember every word you read? No, not every word. But I'm convinced that it does you some good even though you don't remember every word. For that reason, I read a little bit of the Bible every single night. Regardless of how tired I am, I discipline myself to always read a little bit. Maybe 6 or 8 verses, but always some. How many of you remember what you had for dinner 2 weeks ago Tuesday night? Anyone? Did it do you any good? Is it still doing you some good? I suspect so. I suspect there's a few atoms still floating around in your bod somewhere because of some food you ate a couple weeks ago. So it's nourished your body. It's been good for you, even though you don't remember exactly what you've eaten. It's that way with spiritual food. You don't remember every single word you read, but it nourishes your body, your spiritual body. 2 Timothy 3:16. This is one that probably most of you know. All Scripture is inspired and is profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be fully equipped, ready for any good work. So that's a good verse that shows you that when you really study the Bible, it's good for a number of things. It lets you know what's right and wrong. That's what reproof means. You know, that's reproof is when the little funny light goes in your rearview mirror and a little siren, you know, and a guy with a helmet and goggles comes up to your door and says, may I see your driver's license? And then when you hand it to him, you say, what have I done wrong? And he says, you went through the red light back there. You know, he's reproved you. And the Bible says that it's good for reproof, let you know what's right and wrong. And you know, today, as in no other day, we really need a standard of what's right and wrong. So this book, studying this book, will give you a good basis upon which to base your disciplinary program in your home and with yourself. What is right and what is wrong? What are good principles to utilize? They're right here. The Bible says there. Not only do they reprove us, but they show us how to correct the situation when we're wrong. Okay, not only must we have certain convictions, but we must begin with a very important basic assumption. And that is, we must expect a child to act rebellious or sinful. We must begin with the assumption that all children are born sinners. Did you know the Bible says that? For all have sinned, come short of the glory of God. In Romans 6 it says, for by one man, Adam, sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so that death passed upon all men, for all have sinned. Each one of us in this room, when we were born spiritually dead and sinful. Now, a lot of people ask me, why is it that the courts nowadays are so lenient? 94% of those convicted of crimes last year in the city of Los Angeles, 94% were released on some kind of conditional release rather than actually doing jail time. Only 6% jail time. You know that? 44% of those we arrested for armed robbery last year were on parole or probation for armed robbery when we arrested them last year. You know, they'd already done it, we're on some kind of probation. 44%. So there's kind of a, you've heard the old revolving door type of thing. And many people ask me, why is that occurring? In my opinion, it's because of a fallacious assumption they begin with. People in correction and probation, they begin with an assumption that everyone is born good or at least neutral. And therefore, anything they do is because something has happened to them. And they really aren't at fault. It's society or their mother or their father that's at fault. And it's not them. And so, you know, we should punish them. They're not responsible. Society has made them what they are. Let me read you a quote from the Minnesota Crime Commission. This is not a Christian organization. This is a state organization, Minnesota Crime Commission. I think they're very perceptive. They agree with the Bible, by the way, coincidentally. But it's a beautiful statement. It must be remembered that no infant is born a finished product. On the contrary, every baby starts life as a little savage, is equipped, among other things, with organs and muscles over which he has no control, with an urge for self-preservation, with aggressive drives and emotions like anger, fear, and love over likewise which he has practically no control. He is completely selfish and self-centered. He wants what he wants when he wants it, his uncle's watch, his bottle, his mother's attention, his playmate's toy. Deny him those wants, and he seethes with rage and aggression, which would be murderous were he not so helpless. You know, it's really true. You've seen babies. They literally get livid. They get red. You know, their face gets all red, and they scream if they can't have their bottle. And if they had more control over their muscles, and if they had enough strength to pull a trigger on a gun, if they had one, they would use it. They'd kill you right there. You wouldn't give them their bottle. He is dirty. He has no morals, no knowledge, no skills. What this means, of course, is that all children, not just certain children, are born delinquent. And if permitted to continue in the self-centered world of his infancy, given free rein to his impulsive actions to satisfy his wants, every child would grow up a criminal, a thief, killer, rapist. And in the process of growing up, it is normal for every child to be dirty, to fight, to grab, to steal, to tear things apart, to talk back, to evade. And here's their statement. Every child has to grow out of delinquent behavior. Now, you see, the thinking today taught in many of our institutions of higher learning is that we grow into delinquent behavior. We begin good, and we become bad because of some external pressures. Now, I'm sure external pressures influence us. There's no doubt about that. I believe that. But we begin with a sinful nature, and with those external pressures, we just get worse, more gross. If you don't really believe that, those of you who haven't had children, you just wait. You will not have to teach your children to lie. You will not have to teach them to be selfish. You will not have to teach them to punch and to grab and to do things that you tell them not to do. They're just like their old man, you know. It's a nature that we all have. And I recall when my son was just a little guy, he purposely, during those first year or two, you know, in fact, continued on, but especially the first year or so, he tested, always tested. You know, on Thursday nights, when I'd be watching my favorite program at that time, Dragnet, he would stand next to the television set. I'll never forget, this really used to happen. And he had looked at me, you know, and he had reached for the vertical hole because, he felt he was at the control panel of the world, you know, all these pictures and, you know, knobs and all that. So he'd go over there, and he always looked, because he knew that it bugged me, you know, to see the picture go sideways, you know, go, or up and down. And he'd reach forward with his hand, and he'd look at me, and I'd say, Bobby, no. And he knew what no meant. But he'd look at me, and he'd go, like, now what are you going to do, big man, you know? Really, just rebellious. Just that nature that just because I said no, he was going to do it. I really believe this is accurate, because not only is it the results of a crime commission study, but I believe it it also is, of course, the most important reason it's true is because it does agree with Scripture. And what I'm trying to illustrate here is to begin with an assumption that when that life is born, you begin with a delinquent. Now, what happens to him from that point on, for sure you have a lot of influence over it. There's no doubt about that. The environment has a lot to do with what happens to the individual. The so-called onion theory that I've already explained, remember? That an onion is made up of layers upon layer upon layer upon layer. And a personality, I believe, is built upon layer upon layer upon layer. You are the total product of all your experiences, but you begin with a bad seed to begin with. And then all of these layers, many of them bad experiences, depending on your experiences. That's why it's not unusual at all to have murders today. You know, you begin with a bad seed, and then you're exposed to all kind of bad experiences and violence and everything else on television. Is it any wonder why we have people that like to murder just for the fun of it? Doesn't shock me. It's normal. It's not right. But it's to be expected. Yes, sir. The gentleman's statement is that he thinks that the people that make the assumption that we begin neutral or good are in a minority. Well, they may be in a minority. I won't argue that point, but they're in positions of authority where they make decisions. And I've talked to many judges who will say, well, how can you demand that I send this man to prison? It's obvious his mother caused it. And, you know, at one time he was a little helpless, innocent baby. And look what he's become. Who's made him like that? Let me read you one of these verses that I put up there on this assumption that we should expect the child to act rebellious. 5:12, Romans. When Adam sinned, sin entered the entire human race. His sin spread death throughout all the world, so everything began to grow old and die. That's one. Proverbs 22:15 is another verse on this. A youngster's heart is filled with rebellion, but punishment will drive it out of him. And so the assumption there is that you have to expect your child to act rebellious. Don't be surprised when he acts rebellious. Expect your child to have the potential to do anything. You know, one of the biggest problems that I have found in dealing with parents is that they refuse to accept the fact that their child has done something wrong. I've made a lot of arrests where I take the child home, you know, and I'll say, look, we've stopped by the house on the way to the station, but I'm having to take him, I'm having to put him in juvenile hall. What are you taking him to juvenile hall for? Well, you see, he's selling marijuana to school where there were 2 kilos of marijuana in his locker. And my son, absolutely not. He would not do a thing like that. He would not do a thing like that. Son, would you tell your dad what's happened? The policeman's right. Don't say that. You couldn't do that, anything like that. You know? No, I'm serious. I've had him actually tell him to be quiet, that we're making them say something that's not true, and obviously they would not do that. And, you know, I don't know what they've done to you, son. Have they beat you? What have they done to make you say that? I know you wouldn't do that, you know. Yes. The question was, are they really protecting the child or protecting themselves in the way they raise a child? And I think that's very true. It's their own egos hurt, and they refuse to accept the fact that they have failed. Yeah, that's right. But this also is involved, this assumption. Many people are not willing to come up with an assumption. If you have this assumption, it's going to have you do a number of things that you would not do if you did not have this assumption. For instance, later on we're going to talk about what I call inspection and control devices. We'll talk about that later on. I don't know if we're going to get to it tonight, but we'll talk about inspection and control in the area of discipline. And if you have an assumption that basically your child's a sinner, just like you, and that he's going to do some bad things just like you, and that he's capable of really doing almost anything, it'll cause you to set up systems to prevent those things from happening. It'll make you realistic. Okay, not only should we have conviction and a basic assumption that we expect rebelliousness, but thirdly, we're to establish boundaries. Establishment of boundaries and rules that must have the following attributes. Ephesians 6:4, number one, they should be clear, must have clarity. Number two, consistency. You know, if a child really doesn't know what you're talking about and what the rule really means, if it's not clear, he can really be provoked to wrath. I think that's what it's talking about in Ephesians. I haven't read Ephesians 6:4 yet. Let me turn to it and read it. And now a word to you parents. Don't keep on scolding and nagging your children, making them angry and resentful. Rather, bring them up with loving discipline. That's the paraphrase. And I think that implies clarity in the rules and consistency, not an inconsistent matter, not one day it's right to do this and the next day it's wrong and then Friday it's right again and Saturday it's wrong. There has to be consistency, and so that they can kind of predict without asking you what's going to have to happen. They can say to their friends, if their friend says, what do you think your dad would do on this? Well, I know what he'd do. He's as consistent as the day is long. You know, he always says this is wrong. This particular age, this is always wrong. It's never right. I've seen a lot of insecurity and a lot of weird behavior from kids who have parents who are up and down. You know, they're not consistent in the way they deal with things. Consistency is very important. Regularity, as far as the rules are concerned. Enforceability. You shouldn't have a rule that's non-enforceable. You shouldn't have a rule that has a punishment attached to it that you'll never enforce. You know, I see a lot of parents who threaten things I know they'd never follow through with. If you don't do this, you won't be able to go out for 6 months, you know, or whatever. Like, and they know, you know, they say it in rage or anger or whatever, and the kid knows he'll never enforce that. That's too far out. And so they'll go ahead and push ahead to see if that rule's really there. One of the biggest problems that I think we all make in the area of discipline is that we don't enforce what we've said, either because we're too busy, it takes too much time, or some friends are over and you don't want to discipline the child right then, and so you just kind of let it slip by. You say, now, if you know what's going to happen if you do that again? I'm going to have to spank you. So they do it again, and so, you kind of bypass it because you're too busy with your friends or whatever. If your child's really important to you, you'll take them in the other room and you'll discipline them, just like you said you would. You follow through. But also, the rules must be fair. One word that you'll hear a lot from young people is the word fair. Gee, Dad, you're not fair. Or, that's not being fair. You know, that great sense of fairness when they're young. More so than we do. I don't know why that is. But young people have a tremendous sense of fairness and a fair play. And they'll really detect a rule that's not fair, that doesn't have a lot of fairness to it. Next part is the concept of timing. The Bible says very early in life, Proverbs 19:18, and it doesn't give an age there, but I think that early is, you know, right there in the crib, 1 year old, you know. Pardon me? 3 weeks old. As long as it's nice and reasonable, you know, the amount of force. Proverbs 19:18 says this: discipline your son in his early years while there is hope. If you don't, you will ruin his life. In his early years. I think that really means in his early years. As I've said before, the personality is largely formed, they claim now, by age 3. Boy, that's frightening. It's frightening. It makes you want to go back, doesn't it? So the timing is very important. Early in life. Let's take a break and we'll come back and cover the 6 steps of discipline, which are very important to get a hold of. Step number 1, a cooling off period. And the purpose is obvious. It's so that the discipline is given in love. Remember, the Bible says, and we have a whole chapter on it in Hebrews, that discipline and punishment and chastening means actually whipping, should be done in love and should be expression of love. Well, how can you express love when you're angry? How can you express love when you have a lot of rage? And by the way, children can pick up on the motivation. They can detect the motivation. They know whether they're getting spanked in rage or in love. It's very obvious to them. And so for this reason, there should be a cooling off period. Now, sometime it only needs to be 2 or 3 minutes. You know when you've gotten rid of your frustration. But you should maintain control. One of the techniques I used to use is, we have a 2-story house and I tell my son to go up to his room. I say, go up to your room and think this over for a minute and I'll be up. And by the time I gave him time to think it over, I had cooled down. And then by the time I got up to his room and climbed the stairs, it was a little bit of an exercise, and that's always good to exercise when you're mad, you know. And I walked up the stairs, and I had a few minutes to think it over. The anger was gone, and then I was able to discipline in love. So cooling off period is very important. There should be a clear explanation of the purpose of the discipline. That's step number two after the cooling off period. The violation should be clearly explained so they know. Remember the boy that flipped the water on the officer? He said, "What did I tell you? I said one more time and you get it, right? Now what do I have to do?" You know, he understood. I told you one more time, you did it. The purpose of the punishment. I think you should let them know that you're not doing this because you're mad at them. I think you should call attention to the fact that you've waited, even when they're young. See, now look, Daddy purposely waited a few minutes. So I'm no longer mad at you. I'm not mad. But I'm going to spank you anyhow because I think it's right. I think God's Word tells me to do this. I don't really like to do this, but I think it's good for your development. You know, you might use different words depending on the age of the child, but you explain the purpose of the punishment and the biblical responsibility you have. When my son was young, I used to read to him from the Phillips translation of Hebrews 12. I'd just get it out and I'd read it. And after about the fifth time, he said, "Hey, you don't have to read it anymore. I know it." You know, he'd heard it. But I wanted to let him know, this is my biblical responsibility. If I really love you, I will do this. And the godly authority. Sometimes it's a good idea to call their attention to the fact that you do have authority over them. You do have the authority to set the rules and to determine what is a violation, and refer to such chapters as Ephesians 6, where it says, "Children, obey your parents." You see, I have that authority over you. God has given me that authority. God actually is teaching you through me. God's using this chain of command. He's delegated some authority to me, and you're to submit to me. So you have this godly authority. So there's a clear explanation. And then I think it's very important for the child to be forced into admitting to you what he's done. Now, most of the time they will do this. There'll be occasions where they won't. But I think you should try to get them to admit to you after you've given them an explanation of what they've done. Then I think you should ask them, now what did you do? Why is Daddy going to have to spank you? Well, because I disobeyed you. No, that's not clear enough. That's true, of course, but what specifically did you do? Well, you told me to be a good boy. No, it's more than that. What did I tell you not to do that you did? Well, you told me to not tear leaves from the plant out in the backyard. And did you do it? Yes, I tore the leaves from the whatever the plant was, you know. Okay, then you've done something wrong, right? The knowledge of the boundary should be there. They should know just how far they could have gone. When you've set these rules up ahead of time, these reasonable, enforceable, fair rules, they should have a knowledge of the boundary. And at this point, you should not emphasize why did you do it. You shouldn't ask them why did you, because they'll have some explanation. It'll be reasonable. You know, they'll always have that. That's normal to rationalize and say, "Well, I know you told me not to do it, and I did it. However, there was a reason." Well, at this point, that's not that important. Do not ask why, but really get involved in the admission of guilt. And then step number four is the application step. The Bible indicates it should be an article other than the hand when it's physical punishment. Now, these principles apply to all kind of punishment, but especially the physical punishment. Proverbs 23:13 has this to say: "Don't fail to correct your children. Discipline won't hurt them. They won't die if you use a stick on them," or it says, I believe, a rod in the King James. "Punishment will keep them out of hell." You know, I don't think that's for any just coincidence that they referred to a stick or a rod. I think there's an important principle here. Bill Gothard uses an illustration of the little girl that was screaming, "Take it out, take it out." And the parent wondered what she's talking about. Went back in the room after she'd spanked her. And the child was wanting her to take out the brush that she'd used to spank her, because she was mad at the brush. And I talked this over with a psychologist friend of mine. He says, "Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. You know, when they get hurt, they get mad at the article that hurts them. And if it's your hand, they get mad at you. You know, that's not too good." No, really, I'm serious. And so I think it's not by happenstance that the Bible refers to the use of an article other than the hand. And even though there's a cooling off period, it shouldn't be so long that it loses its connection with the offense. It should be soon after the violation. Now, this is not in conflict with step number one. But Ecclesiastes 8:11 has something very interesting to say. I'll read from, once again, the Living Version. It says this: because God does not punish sinners instantly, people feel it is safe to do wrong. How does that read in the New American Standard? Does someone have a New American Standard? Yes, would you read it out loud? I think that's the accurate word-for-word translation from the original text. And it clearly indicates that that's one of the things that you must have in any kind of punishment, and that is some relationship to the offense. That's another reason why our criminal justice system today doesn't work. It takes an average of 9 months to bring a guy to trial for a felony offense in Los Angeles. That's too long. And sometimes it's years. You know, it averages 9 months. Some are a little sooner than that. Most of them are more than that. And somehow it averages out to about 9 months. There are some countries, for instance, in Turkey, where it's possible to be sentenced and executed within 3 or 4 days. You know, found guilty, sentenced, and executed right then. Some friends of ours were over in Turkey here a few years ago, and on the same floor where they were staying, a woman was raped, and they caught the guy that did it. And they were only in the city a few days. And by the time they were gone, the guy was already sent up to the prison. He was already sentenced. And they said, you know, they don't have too many rapes in that city. It was kind of an unusual thing. The police were kind of amazed because this didn't happen too often. So it should be soon after the violation. And then step number five, the release of guilt step. This is very important. You should call to their attention that although they've done something wrong, since you have executed some kind of punishment on them, the guilt is taken away. You now forgive them. God forgives. You forgive. They paid the penalty. And they're starting kind of fresh and new with a clean slate. And then some type of expression of love. The last step, step six. Probably the most important step. Now, if all of these steps are followed, I guarantee it'll be effective. I can guarantee it. I think that the concept of punishment itself is the most important thing. I think that physical punishment is necessary at early ages, or I don't think it would be in the Bible. It refers to it so much. There are oodles and oodles of verses. We've given you five or six tonight to talk about physical punishment. So I think it's important. But I think it, and we'll get to this a little later on, I think it's mainly for the early ages. And what is early? It depends on when they start getting more mature. I've spanked boys as old as 16 and 17 years old. Now, spank them. I mean, hit them with a bodor. But I don't do that with girls. Once they start puberty, as far as girls are concerned, I don't think physical punishment's the way. That's a personal opinion. It's not gospel, you know. But let me give you an illustration of how this system works, and I think it might answer your question. I'm on the board of directors at Hume Lake Christian Camps, and we have a lot of young people come up there, about 450 in high school camp each week, a different group, and about half of them are girls and half are boys, high schoolers. If you don't think that's a problem, you know, for a week in the same camp, cabins just a few feet apart, you know, you've got control problems. And so we have some very strict rules up there. One of the rules is you don't go in the girls' area and the girls don't go in the boys' area. You know, that's King's X. They just don't violate that. And we let them know if they do, they're going to get physical punishment. The boys aren't. And another rule is that they don't use drugs. And I tell them that also. I say, if you use drugs, I'm going to spank you with a bodor. And that's actually what I have. I have a regular oak bodor from a rowboat that I've cut about in half. So I have about 4.5 feet of it, mostly paddle, you know. And it's solid, you know. I haven't broke one yet. We got three guys. First night of camp, I think it was. I came around the corner of one of the buildings, and the one guy had just taken the last few hits off the joint. When he saw me coming, he ate the rest of it. So I didn't have any evidence, you know. So I couldn't bust him. I didn't really want to bust him, but there was no arrest because they didn't have any physical evidence, but I knew what they had done. They knew I knew what they had done. I come around the corner and said, "Man, we just got rid of it." And I said, "Yeah, but I know all three of you have been blowing pot, right?" And they said, "Yeah, but you can't bust us." And I said, "Yeah, but what did I tell you would happen at the first meeting?" They said, "Well, oh yeah, yeah, you said you'd whack on us." I said, "Well, look, you're up here by choice, and you're not my son, so I can't force you to be punished by me. I'm going to give you a decision to make." And I always tell them this at Hume Lake. They're not my kids. I can't wail on them, you know. So I say, "Look, you have a choice to make. I either have to send you back home, or I have to punish you. Because if you're going to stay up here, you have to be under my control. Now, you have a choice. I'll send you home, or if you want to stay, you have to submit to my punishment." And I haven't had any of them yet go home. They always want to stay. And so then I go in and I get their folks on the line. I call them long distance, collect, and tell them what's happened, and say, "Now look, caught your son doing this, and if you'd like to talk to him, confirm this, but I'm telling you, I caught him doing this, and he's elected to stay here and submit to my punishment. What do you think?" Usually they say, "How many whacks?" I say, "3. Give him 10. So, well, yeah. 10's too many with a bodor. But anyhow, I told these guys, I said, "Okay, first offense, I'm going to give you 3. You know, that's minimum. The first one hurts. The second one, you know, the flesh is already quivering and really hurting, you know. And when that second one hits, it really hurts. And the third one is unbelievable. I've never had a kid yet that doesn't tear up a little bit. I mean, big 16-year-old guys, you know, they'll tear up a little bit." So then I say, "Okay, you guys have elected to do this, so let's go in the office." So we go in, and I sit down. I just rap with them for maybe 10, 15 minutes. And I say, "Okay, look, if I was angry with you, I'm not anymore. Do you guys believe that?" Step number one. "All right, yeah, yeah, we can dig it." I say, "Okay, I really am not mad at you. However, what did I catch you doing?" Just kind of combine here. "Yeah, we blew some pot." "What did I say last night?" "You said if we blew pot, you'd have to spank us." "Okay, I think enough of you guys, and I'm going to follow through. Now, I want to call your attention to something. This has taken now, from the time I caught you until now, it's taken over an hour. I could be out there playing volleyball with Ken Porn and some of the guys, you know. But here I am, in here with you guys. I've had to make long-distance phone calls, big hassle, you know. My time's in here, and I could be out getting the raise and having a good time, right?" "Right." "You know why? Because I think enough of you. I want to follow through. Now, I want you guys to tell me. I want you guys to say it with your own words. What did you do?" "Joe, I smoked some pot." "What did you do?" "I smoked some pot. I blew some pot." "Okay. Let's go on to phase 4 here. The application. You two guys go out of the room. Joe, come here. Let's see. Take your wallet out of your pants here and... look, don't put your hands in back when I start hitting because it might break a finger." You know, and that usually kind of freaks them out a little bit. When "I want you to bend over and grab your ankles." Reach over and grab their ankles. And they get that bodor, and I really give them a whack. I mean really. So much so that it knocks them forward off their feet. They come back, and I say, "It's all right. You can kind of rub it out in between." Walking around and pausing. Going on for the second one, give it to them the second time. The third time, by that time there's a few tears, you know, or at least there's fogging up. And I go up and I grab them and I always do this. I always congratulate them. I say, "Congratulations, took it like a man." And the guys, you know. and then I go to step number 5 here. "I want you to know that you have paid the penalty. And because of that, you're on the same basis with everybody else in camp. You're not on probation. You don't have something hanging over you. You know, I'm not mad at you. You have paid the penalty. I've just wiped your slate clean. You're starting all over again. You understand that?" "Yeah." You know, it's kind of a neat feeling they get. It's kind of a cleansing kind of feeling where they, you know, the scales are balanced. They've had some guilt, and that guilt's been removed. "You know, you paid the penalty. Now I forgive you. Now we're right back on level ground again." That's a very important step. And then this last step, you say, how do you do that with guys that aren't your son that are 16 years old? Various ways you express love. You grab the guy by his arm, you kind of sock him in the bicep, you know, in the trapezoid or whatever, you know, just kind of give him a good hit, say, hey man, I'm with you. Look him in the eyeball, you know, kind of a masculine hug. I like to pray for you. Oh, all right. And you pray for him, and you ask God to help him not to be tempted to do it again. And I've had a lot of guys during that time of just a kind of a masculine grasp around the shoulders and heads bowed and praying for him. I've had a lot of them just break down and just weep, just sob. And you know, these three guys, I'll never forget, two of them were Anglos and one of them was black. And the last night at camp, it was Friday night, we were down around the fireplace and we were talking in the lodge there, Ponderosa Lodge. We were talking about the week, and the next morning all the kids were going back home and we just had a candlelight communion and everything. We were talking about some of the victories and some of the problems of the week. And we heard some kids run up on the porch and knock at the door, and the door was open. And these three guys, they said, is Mr. Vernon here? And the consul who answered the door said, yeah. And they came running at me, and I thought, my gosh, they're getting even. You know? First time it's happened. You know? But they came running at me, and I really thought they were, you know, last night there wasn't anything I could do now. They could refuse and be sent home, so big deal. You know, they're going home anyhow. But instead, they all three begin hugging me. And they begin crying. And I'll never forget, especially this one black kid. He grabbed me, and tears rolling down his cheeks. And he said, thank you, thank you. No one ever cared enough for me before it ever spanked me. No one ever cared enough for me. And he's weeping. And, you know, that experience, and many like it, you know, that wasn't unusual. We have a lot of experiences like that at Hume Lake. Physical punishment, but in conjunction with these steps of discipline, I think biblical steps are very effective. And, you know, I have a file at home. My wife has kept a file. I have 30 or 40 letters from kids that I've spanked at Hume Lake. And they get home and they get thinking about it. And I've remarkable letters. This was a turning point in my life. You know, letters like that. One time of discipline. And they're so impressed with it that quite often it turns a guy around. I went to Van Nuys First Baptist Church after we had them up for a week, right near the end of summer. This is about 3 years ago. And I spoke that night. We all came back together. It was at Labor Day weekend. I came back and I spoke in the evening church service. And I noticed there was a bunch of guys, about six or seven, that I had spanked that week. And they were all down there. And they all had their parents. And once again, I wondered, what's going on? Are they, you know, did they tattle or something and all that? And their parents are going to be angry with me? And the parents came up and they said, we don't know what you did to our sons, but whatever, fantastic. These guys, you know, they're different. A lot of parents have asked me, they've come into the station and they say, you know, my kids threaten me. They say, if you lay a hand on me, I'll call the cops on you for child beating. That should be clarified. There is a law on child beating, but child beating is not the same as spanking. Beating is causing some kind of permanent injury where it's done unreasonably. It's done in such a way that it causes injury to the child. You know, we're very careful to use a broad paddle. We're very careful to use it on the fluteus maximus, you know, on the big muscles there, and it doesn't cause any permanent. It hurts for the moment, but there's no bruises or lacerations or anything like that. In child beating, there has to be some kind of corporal injury. The law definitely allows the whipping and the correct discipline of a child. In fact, I've had a lot of parents say, now look, if you're not sure, if you feel funny about this, bring your child into the station and I'll supervise him. I'll hold him for you if you think he's too big for you. And I've done that many times. A lot of mothers bring in their child and say, you know, I just can't handle him. I say, well, I can handle him for you, and I'll hold him while you know, do your thing. And you have to be careful to, you know, keep him under control. Some of them get a little hot. You know, this is the first time they've been able to do it, and they really go at it. I had one parent come in one night, and this actually happened. It was at night. It was around 11 o'clock at night. We'd picked up this boy. He had some wine, and he was kind of wild. And so we brought him in, and I called the dad, and the dad came there. We'd picked up maybe 15 or 20 kids that night, and I had a whole kind of an auditorium outside in the hall of parents and children, you know, all sitting waiting their turn for the counseling. So I brought in this one parent and his child, and I said, this is what he's done wrong. And he had some Thunderbird wine, and here's the bottle, and smell his breath, and, you know, and see how he's acting. And yeah, he really is. Now, what do you think I should do, officer? I said, well, I'm not going to file a petition in court because he's never been arrested before, but I do think he deserves a spanking. Even though he's 16, I really do. I think he deserves a spanking, and soon. And I meant, you know, as soon as you get him home. And I brought in the next group, you know, and I was talking with them, and I heard this guy's voice outside. No, Dad, not here. No, Dad, you know. And I got up, and I looked outside, and what he had done, he wanted to make sure he heard him, so he made him drop his trousers to his underwear. And the whole hall was full of people, you know. And he was really embarrassed, and he was laying it on him with his belt, you know, right there. I said, no, not here, sir. You know. Take him home. Yes. Okay, the question is, do I think that these principles will work in spite of the fact that a child comes out of an environment where he has never been exposed to these before? And the answer is, my opinion is yes, they will work. And I've seen it work. The examples I've given you, this young black fellow who told me no one ever cared enough for me to spank me, obviously it worked for him. He was impressed that it was an expression of love. He really felt that strongly. And the letters that I have in my file at home are a testimony of the fact that it works with kids who have never been exposed to discipline. So my opinion is yes, that these principles will work, whether they're utilized early in life or whether they're imposed later on. I think it's better to utilize these principles early in life and have a consistency, for sure. But I don't think that we have to say that just because they haven't been exposed earlier, we can't use them. I think they still work. To repeat his question, he says, in other words, saying that it's too late, that they're too old, that you can't change them. It's much, much harder, and there's much more opportunity for failure. But I still think that they're sound principles and that they should be tried. And once again, depending somewhat on age, some people at 16 are as adult as other people are at 21. And if they're extremely worldly wise and savvy and no longer can really be considered as a youngster, adolescent, then they perceive that also, and they're not going to respond to any type of discipline. Well, I shouldn't say any type, but it's going to be rare that they will respond. Most of the kids that we get at camp are kids, or they wouldn't be in camp. You know, the kind of guy that would come to a camp is still fun-loving adolescent looking for a good time. We don't get too much the 16-year-old pimp off the street. And there are 16-year-old pimps that know a lot more about street life than any of us in this room. You know, they're so savvy and sophisticated as far as the world is concerned that they're like a 25-year-old who's been through an awful lot, and I don't know if these principles would be effective. I'd try them. But I frankly doubt whether they really would be effective. We're really talking about still a person who is impressionable. Positive discipline. There's the law of reinforcement. And the law of reinforcement goes like this, that behavior which achieves desirable consequences will reoccur. And that's very important to recognize. That's kind of a behavioralist viewpoint, but it's true. It's like old Pavlov's dog, you know. You ding a bell every time you feed the dog, and pretty soon you dig a bell and he salivates. You know, the saliva flows from his mouth. He's conditioned to know that the bell goes along with food. And we can actually condition youngsters that certain kind of behavior begats certain good things that they like. And so they'll want to have those good things repeat, and so they'll do that kind of good behavior. So I want to have a transition here from negative discipline to positive discipline using the concept of reinforcement. One of the things that, and I'm not talking about giving suckers and things like that. I'm talking about real important things that we need. In the positive reinforcement area, we need to reward immediately, soon after the behavior. To ring the bell for the dog 10 minutes after probably won't have very much of an effect of conditioning. And the reward need not be material. We're not just talking about money or a chocolate soda or a new reflector like I talked about last week, that's one thing. Of course, that's one way of rewarding. But one of the most important concepts of reward is the matter of praise. Praise fosters assurance and confidence. You want to know why we have so many insecure people today? Because they don't have praise. Boy, that's one of the most valuable things you can give your child is praise. When he does something right, pat him on the head, pat him on the back, say, hey, great job. Even if it's not a very good job, you know, if it's good for him, give him praise. You know, that little picture that he brings home when he's in kindergarten, and you don't even know what it is. And so you think, oh, that's beautiful. What do you call it? And he says, yeah, it's a boat. Beautiful boat, you know. You're not even sure. That praise, and boy, he just stands there. You ever watch a little kid and do that? Man, they love that. We're all like that. We humans need that. I don't mean humans. We adults. Children are human. See, you didn't even catch it, did you? We adults need this praise. And praise fosters assurance and confidence. It really does. And to, you know, let them know that we're with them. And we really think that they've done a good job. I use this a great deal in my management principles at work with adult policemen. Young sergeant came in when I took over as captain of Action Investigation Division. He said, I'd like to begin a report of the week club. This is kind of a club. He said, we're gonna put it on the board, the bulletin board. And I said, well, what do you mean, Ben? He said, well, we make about 150 traffic reports a day in this division, right? I said, right. He said, why not get the auditor's office, we have a traffic report auditor's office, why not get the auditor's office to send down to you two or three reports out of those 150 a day every Thursday, and Friday you can post them on the bulletin board. You can post the one that you think is the best investigation of the week. I said, now wait a minute, Ben. We're dealing with adult men, policemen. We're not dealing with a bunch of kids. That's like putting a star next to a guy's name when he's present or something, you know. When you're a little kid, you do that, but you don't do that with policemen. He said, Captain, can we try it? I said, all right, we'll try it for a couple of weeks. So we got these reports down from the auditor's office, two or three, and I selected one I thought was the best, and I circled a few things with a big red felt pen, you know. The officers got themselves dirty by getting under the car and checking the brake lines and found out that's what caused the accident. It was a good investigation, you know, and so I circled it and I said, fantastic investigation. Went to a lot of trouble. Good commitment. RLV, put my initials, put it up on the board. Labeled, report of the week. And two or three weeks later, it was a Friday afternoon, and it was about 3:30. The early day watch got off about 3:15. And yet, the early day watch crew, they were still standing around in the watch commander's office. And I looked at my calendar, and I said to my secretary, I went out in the outer office, I said, hey, Mary, this isn't Wednesday. What's the day watch hanging around for? What's going on? Their checks aren't here. Every other Wednesday, the checks come in. You know, they wait around. She said, you haven't put up the report of the week yet. And I said, you're kidding me. They're waiting for the report of the week? That Mickey Mouse idea? She said, that may be Mickey Mouse, but they're waiting for it, you know. I put it on your desk and you haven't signed one yet. So I quickly got one and circled a couple things. Good work, RLV. Tana Tour, she went out. And of course, you know, policemen, they don't like to admit that they're waiting for that, you know. And when it goes up, whoever's there, you know, they give them the right, oh, yeah, and all that kind of stuff, you know, like this guy's, you know, he's really a bad dude. But really, it was very important to him to get this pat on the back, to get this recognition of a job well done. So important that they were willing to stay a few minutes overtime without getting paid for it to see who's getting up there. And I thought that was kind of significant. We kept that program going. When I went out to Venice Division, we started an Officer of the Month deal where we selected an officer whose accomplishments were very significant. We enlarged the big picture of him and put a citation, whereas, therefore, let it be resolved. And we had it presented to him by the local Lions Club and all that. And after we had it posted in the station for a month, we give it to him to take home, put up in his den. Man, that's important to these guys, you know. They're adults, but it's important to them. And how much more is it important to someone who's growing up and who needs that security that recognition can give. Praise. Attention normally focuses on negative behavior. It's important to recognize that. You know the old saying, the squeaking wheel gets the oil. And so we have to make a conscious effort to focus our attention on good behavior. You have to remind yourself to focus on good behavior. It's natural to focus on negative behavior because you have to deal with it. He's done something wrong, you got to make sure he doesn't do it again. So you focus on that. And if you don't watch out, that's all you're talking to him about. Negative, negative, negative. You've done wrong. You must get spanked. You've done this, you've done that. Wrong. It's important to recognize that attention normally does focus on negative behavior, and force yourself to focus on positive behavior and give it attention and praise. Okay, preparing for self-discipline. It's important to recognize the concept of preparing a child for self-discipline. The whole purpose of imposed discipline is based on the assumption that someday he's going to be free and have to make up his own mind and develop his own values and discipline himself. In fact, the whole disciplinary process in the home should be based on the assumption that you're preparing them to be completely on their own, that someday you're not going to be there to look at them and say, that's wrong, that's right. And so you begin by recognizing the fact that they are going to be away from you someday, and it's going to be sooner than you think. And you start working toward that day of, quote, freedom, unquote. And keep that in the back of your mind. You know, too many parents refuse to accept that. And they keep their child so much under their control that the child becomes so dependent upon them for control that when they turn 18 and the control suddenly is released, man, they just freak out and go wild. They say, now I can do whatever I please. And they do all kind of weird things. Because a parent has not gotten ready for that. They haven't prepared the child for that freedom. And so, step number one, in preparing for self-discipline, you must have planned denial experiences. Because, as I said earlier, that's real life. They will run into denial experiences. They will run into people who say, no, I don't want you to work for me. No, you can't have a job. No, you can't do this. Yes, you have to do this in order to get a job here, or whatever. They're going to run into experiences that will be against their will. You have to prepare them for that. And so the reason I've indicated here planned denial experiences, I think it's important to deny your children some things once in a while, even if you have the capability, the means, to give it to them. Now let me repeat that. Even if you have the money, the resources, the time, to say yes to every question they ask you, every request, I think it's important to occasionally throw in a denial experience. Just because real life is going to be like that. And you've got to get them ready. Remember, the assumption is you're preparing them for complete freedom. So you actually plan denial experiences. Now some people say, wow, that's kind of weird. Do you mean even if you have the money to let them go to the show and they want to go to the show on Saturday, occasionally you say no? That's right. If there's no reason to say no, occasionally you say no. Just so they're ready for the real life experiences of someone saying no to them. Now, you don't do it all the time. When you can, you say yes. And once in a while, even when you can say yes, though, you say no. You have a planned denial experience. Now, once in a while, my son, for instance, will say, Dad, I've got all my homework done, and I want to watch this movie. And he's watched television every night that week. Once in a while, I'll say, I don't want any television tonight. I don't want any television. Why? Well, I'd like to talk to you, number one. But number two, I think it's good to just take a breather and not do it. Yeah, but I don't have any reason not to, and I don't have anything to talk about. You know? Well, yeah, but I've decided that tonight I'm going to say no. Well, in effect, yeah, that's right. But you should have also another reason. I usually have one in ready, like I do want to talk to him, you know? But to deny him just being able to do whatever he wants all the time. See, that's a bad pattern to get into, where you can always do what you want. That may sound weird, but really, I think it's important for a person to get used to an occasional, not all the time, but an occasional denial experience. Notice I've said even when it's not necessary, because that's real-world practicality. And self-restraint is going to be necessary some later time. Once he gets into a pattern of being able to cope with an experience where he knows that he can do it, but he's told for some reason, no. Later on, he'll be able to exert self-restraint. The next very important concept is a gradual expansion of freedom and responsibility. A gradual expansion where you give more freedom the older he gets. This gradual expansion of freedom begins with non-critical issues. Okay, you don't want him to mess up his life at a young age by allowing him to have freedom in a very important area. Guy comes in and says, Dad, I want to smoke pot. What do you think? Well, I'm preparing you for freedom. Make up your own mind. You know, really, now that sounds funny, but I've actually heard parents say that. They say, well, I believe that since he's going to have to make up his own mind later on, I let him make up his mind. And I say, yeah, but there are certain areas where you cannot afford to let him make up his own mind. There are critical areas. You can't say, well, if you want to try arsenic once, that's all right. If you know, no, you do. You cannot let him try arsenic. He'll die. And there are some very critical things you cannot give him freedom in, but the non-critical things, there are plenty of non-critical things you can give him some freedom in. And you give him more as they get older, and more. And it's good for them to get used to freedom. I do think it's important, though, even in non-critical issues, to explain your own opinion on why perhaps you would not do it, even though you're going to allow them to do it, because it's non-critical. It's not going to hurt them. It's not going to have any long-range damage on them. But, you know, you yourself would not do this. But you say, well, I'm getting you ready for freedom. And I tell my son this all the time. I level with him. I let him know what I'm doing. I say, hey, Bob, a couple years, you're going to be 18. I'm getting you ready for freedom. So I'm not going to say, no, you can't do this. But let me tell you why I wouldn't do it. And I explain my opinion. Give him all the reasons. I wouldn't do it for the following reasons. Does that mean I can't do it? No, I didn't say that. You get to make up your mind. Now, for instance, we're at the point now where I do not, and for a couple years I haven't, I do not make my son come to church. I don't. No. He'll ask me every now and then on a Sunday night, hey, Dad, do I have to go to church tonight? I say, hey, remember what I told you a long time ago? I'm getting you ready for freedom. You don't have to go to church tonight. But let me tell you why I'm going to church tonight. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Pretty soon he goes upstairs and gets on his coat. He comes down and he gets in the car. It's really something. It's great to prepare him for freedom. And one of the ways that most of the time they'll do what you want them to do, even though you give them the ultimate responsibility, is allow them the advantage of knowing your opinion and giving them your insights and your principle, but still allow him. And once in a while, he doesn't go upstairs and get his coat. A couple weeks ago, he didn't. I said, get ready to go to church. He says, man, there's really something on Disney World I got to see. And I said, well, you know, Bob, tonight the message is going to be on this, and I have three things supporting him. I'm going to church for the following reason. 1, 2, 3, 4. He says, that's very interesting, but if I can stay home, I stay home. You know? And a lot of, some of you may disagree with me, but I say, okay. You know, because I realize in a couple years, you know, he's going to have freedom if he wants it. Complete. And I don't want to blow it. I don't want him to be out of control. And so I'll say, well, okay. You can, if you want to, you can stay home. Now, he hasn't done that too many times. I can only count 2 times in the last year where he hasn't come to church with me. You know, 99% of the time, he comes. And I think it's more important to have him come willingly, getting ready for freedom, than to say, you will come. You know, he's 16 years old. You will come to church with me. You shall. But I don't want, you shall come. He gets bitter. I think it's important to recognize this concept of getting ready for that freedom if he wants it. And the question somebody asked, is he really free at 18? That's right. If they want to run away from home, they can do it at 18. And there's thousands of kids on the streets that have. The parents don't have any control. Of course, the control they have is they cannot sign for their driver's license, but they'll drive anyhow. You know. But they can actually have freedom at 18 if they want it. Of course, they got the responsibility with that. And give warnings. I think it's very important. I've talked to a lot of parents who give the freedom, but they don't give warnings. They don't say, yeah, but if you do this, you know what's going to happen to you? This is what's going to happen to you. You're going to get hurt. Or this is going to result in this. It's important to give warnings. And most important of all, place responsibility. See, now look, I'm giving you the right to make up your mind on this, but I want you to know something. You're going to be responsible for your actions. I'm going to hold you responsible. Let me give you an example. I give my son so much money for working with me. For instance, we just got to paint the house. I'm going to pay him for helping me paint the house. And it's his money. And quite often, he'll want to spend his money on some things that I think are foolish. You know, it's just blowing his money, and I don't think it's right. And I'll tell him so. I'll say, now, I don't think you should spend it for this, on this, for the following reasons. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think it's foolishness for these following reasons. And then he'll say, well, I understand what you're saying, but I still want to buy it. I say, okay, I want you to know something. I'm not going to advance you any money. When you see something else you really want, that's really neat, like in a couple weeks, I'm not going to advance you any money. If you spend that money and blow it, man, you're going to have to live without money. I place a responsibility on him, and sometime it comes back to haunt him. He'll come back, hey, Dad, can I have a couple bucks? I want to, hey, man, you blew your money. Remember what I told you? I let you spend it, but now you're going to have to live with that decision you made. Yeah, but you got plenty of money. Dad, you give me a couple bucks. Yeah, I can. You're right. But I want you to get used to responsibility. Someday you're going to have it. So I'm trying to give you some right now. And I called your attention to the fact that if you spent this money, you wouldn't have anything for something you wanted later on. Now you want something, right? You don't have it, right? You spent something I think is foolish. And I think by now you think it was foolish. Yeah. He goes walking away, kicking the dirt, kind of mad at me, you know? But this matter of placing responsibility is very important. It is important to make occasional audits on your children. It really is. Don't take their word for everything they do. And boy, the big thing that comes up is, Dad, don't you trust me? And you know what I say? No. And some of you say, oh, shame, you should never say that to your children. You know how I respond? I say, no, I don't trust you because you're just like I was when I was your age. It's not you personally I don't trust, it's your adolescence I don't trust. You see, because I was there. I was your age. And I remember I needed some help. And I needed my dad to check on me once in a while, to keep me where I should be. And I don't trust your adolescence, Bob. So, you know, you're right. I don't trust you. Explain an honest trust situation with them. Explain what you mean. Explain the fact that you want to trust them, and that's why you're occasionally checking, because you want to build your trust in them. And, of course, if they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, this will build your trust. For instance, let me give you a practical example. I can't tell you how many times I've been at parties, at 3 o'clock in the morning, pot parties, you know, you round up a bunch of kids, and you start calling parents, and you call Susie's parents, and you say, hello, this so-and-so, your mother of Susie, whatever. We have your daughter here. We arrested a pot party over on Penrose. A pot party? She's supposed to be over at Gladys's house, you know. And, well, Gladys is with her, too, but they're not at Gladys's house, you know. And you call Gladys's mother, and, well, she's supposed to be over at Susie's house, you know. And they're all across, you know, they're all supposed to be at different places, and they're at neither. I think it's real important when, for instance, on an overnight thing like that, when they're teenagers, 14, 15 years old, I think it's great for a parent to call the parents of the house they're going to. That seems basic to me, but a lot of parents don't do it. Say, Mrs. Jones, Bob says he wants to come over to your house tonight, spend a night with John. Is that all right with you? Yeah, I don't know anything about it, you know. Wow, that'd be nice to know. In fact, John said he was going over to Bob's house tonight. Oh, you know. Fortunately, that's never happened to me on these checks, but it could. And when I do call, you know, Bob's first reaction when this first happened, hey, Dad, you treat me like a little kid. No, I'm just interested in you. Trying to make sure that everything's just right. Don't you trust me? Well, I don't trust your adolescence completely. And I really want to make sure it's all right with Mrs. Jones. I don't want you over here if she doesn't want you there. Talk to her. And so you explain this thing, and you reevaluate and adjust freedom where necessary. But every now and then you have to reevaluate, and you have to take a look at the situation and where they violated your trust a little bit. You have to pull back in. You have to call their attention to that. Say, now look, before I let you make up your mind on this, but you violated my trust. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to pull back the reins a little bit until you prove once again that I can trust you. And you'd be very candid with me. But the overall trend is one of building toward complete freedom. If you've got a teenager and you're not building toward complete freedom, you're going to be in trouble. Results are peace to the recipient. Hebrews 12:11. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So to the person that's a recipient of discipline, ultimately it brings peaceful fruit of righteousness. It really brings peace. Proverbs 29:17, happiness to the parent, would you believe? Proverbs 29:17. I've heard some people put it this way. They say, you know, children can either be the greatest joy in the world and the greatest fulfillment, or they can be the greatest curse. And I've seen some parents who are literally destroyed emotionally and everything else by their children. Their children have gone off on such weird rebellious kicks that their whole lives are ruined. I mean, the parents, you know, they're in such deep distress over the children that they really can't live a happy life. But yet it says that when you discipline your children, in Proverbs 29:17, let me read this to you. Correct your son and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul. Really bring happiness. And I guess that's the last of the results. But let me just conclude by saying this. One of the most important concepts that is overlooked today is this matter of discipline. And I think it's important to recognize the concepts we've gone over. And lastly, I'd like to read the following quote from J. Adams again on Competent to Counsel from his book. As children grow into their teens, the problem becomes less a matter of the parent structuring responsibility and discipline into the life of a child, and more a matter of helping the child to assume responsibility for structuring his own life. Once again, that's the concept of preparing for freedom, gradual freedom, structuring in his own life responsibility. Let's bow our head in a word of prayer tonight as we've talked about discipline. Father, this is an area that we've talked about tonight that is so important, often abused, and many times even overlooked. We ask that as real men that have been given the responsibility by you to assume this masculine role of leader, that you would give us the intestinal fortitude to abide by the concepts that we've learned from your book relating to discipline. Father, may we be disciplined ourselves. May we lead by example. But may we also have the commitment. May we demonstrate our love by spending the time that is necessary to really be godly men in disciplining our children. We'll be careful to thank you, for we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.